Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. It's trite but true that we're living in an era of mass migration when millions of people are on the move, mostly within countries and regions, but also between regions. Europe and the United States are compelling destinations to people fleeing war, climate extreme, hunger, sectarian violence, poverty, and a host of other disasters. But those prime destination countries are at best reluctant to admit all comers, regardless of either their status or of the commitments made under international treaties and compacts. Indeed, the politics of immigration dominate electoral discourse in many countries, so their governments look for ways to push migrants back to where they came from, or at least out of sight. That takes many forms, but increasingly transit and origin countries are being paid to stop or to warehouse the unwanted. For Europe, that has meant lucrative deals with the governments of Tunisia, Morocco, Mauritania, Libya, and others. On paper, such arrangements can be made to sound like humane, sensible solutions to the risks of leaky boats crossing the Mediterranean or furtive treks across unguarded bits of borders. But are they? How are these monies and the hundreds of millions of euros actually used? How are would-be refugees treated? Who assures their safety and survival? There are answers to those questions, but they aren't pretty. Recently, a collaboration of journalists, led in part by the Dutch-based organization Lighthouse Reports, published something they called Desert Dump. One of the authors of that report, who is the investigations editor of Lighthouse Reports, is May Bulman, who joins us today. Welcome, May, to New Thinking for a New World.
Hi, Alan. Thanks for having me.
May, in this case, I'm afraid the new thinking that's going on is by governments who are thrashing around for innovative ways, maybe not good ways, but innovative ways, to stop the flow of migrants into Europe. Let's start with the headline of your piece. Why did you guys call the story Desert Dump?
Good question. We kind of called it Desert Dumps really from a very early stage in the investigation, because what we were hearing from the beginning was that mainly Black migrants, Black refugees, migrant workers who were in North Africa were being rounded up and basically taken to desert areas, arid desert areas, and left there by the authorities of those North African countries. So this, you know, the term desert dumps actually summed that up quite well, as we were obviously trying to corroborate that and understand what was actually going on and the extent to which these reports were true. We, you know, were ready to potentially change that title if we didn't manage to prove it, but we did. I mean, we found that this was actually happening on a systematic scale. And that's exactly what it is. People are being dumped in the desert.
So tell the story. Who's being dumped? Who's doing the dumping? Why are they dumping? And we'll get eventually to what can be done about it.
Perhaps. Yeah. Okay. So I'm obviously investigations editor at Lighthouse Reports, and we worked together with, well, we coordinated a collaborative investigation involving 8 media outlets across Europe and the US as well. That was around 40 journalists involved. And what we did is we focused on 3 North African countries, Morocco, Tunisia, and Mauritania, all countries that we know are in receipt of large amounts of funding for migration management from the EU and from European countries. And what we found is that many refugees and migrant workers, some of whom were on their way towards Europe, so passing through North Africa, trying to get to Europe, others who actually had legal status in those North African countries and established livelihoods and were working there, but that they were being apprehended, or still are being apprehended, based on the color of their skin. So mainly sub-Saharan Africans we're talking about, loaded onto buses and then driven to the middle of nowhere, like, as I said, often arid desert areas. And then we found that they're being left without any assistance, without water, without food, leaving them at high risk of dehydration, sometimes even death. And crucially, we found that these practices, that these operations are being funded by the EU and European countries. And I think this, you know, the reason we did this was that obviously we were hearing reports about it, and there have been the odd news report that this sort of thing was happening, but no one had yet tried to document the European knowledge and the European involvement in these anti-migrant, racially motivated operations in North Africa. And yeah, essentially we exposed how not only has this system of mass displacement and abuse been known about in Europe, in Brussels for years, but that it's also run thanks to money, vehicles, equipment, intelligence and security forces provided by the EU and European countries. I can talk a bit about how we kind of got to these findings, if that would be helpful.
I very much want to do that, but before you do, let's try to scale this. Your report, your team worked for about a year, is my understanding.
That's right, yeah.
And order of magnitude, can you put some frame on how many migrants we're talking about? You said you're focused on the three countries. Any order of magnitude, how much money flowing from the EU, Italy, and other countries? Can we scale it for our listeners and then tell the story of what you actually found?
Sure. So we established that there are tens of thousands of people being rounded up and taken to desert areas every year across these three countries. And that's based on statistics we were able to gather and documents. So it's happening on a wide scale. And, you know, some of the countries actually record this. So, for example, Morocco actually records, has data showing how many migrants they've apprehended, whether at borders or inland, and who they say that they've kind of dispersed. So, you know, these countries aren't...
Dispersed is the term of art?
I think that's the term they use. They at least say... You know, they've been, okay, no, I think the term was prevented from crossing. So, but essentially like moved away from the border. Right. And we, you know, we know from the work we've been doing on the ground and from speaking to, we spoke to more than 50 survivors of these expulsions. Matt, and we know from that, yeah, this is what this means. You know, if people are arrested and then they're taken as far away from the coast as possible, which often means to the borders and to very deserted areas. So yeah, I mean, it's happening on that kind of scale. In terms of the money, we were able to establish that, I mean, getting the totals is quite difficult because it's not, we really, you know, looking into the EU's finances, it's not very transparent, but we were able to find that the EU's largest migration management pot of funding, like for third countries, which is called the EU Trust Fund for Africa, that under that, hundreds of millions have been paid to those three countries up in the last kind of, I think, since 2015. But then on top of that, there's loads of other EU-funded projects that, again, were very difficult to kind of to add up because it's really a very opaque system to understand.
So let's focus first on the people, and then I want to come back to the money and to Europe. What happens to the people? What did your teams discover?
I can talk through a few cases. I mean, like I said, we spoke to more than 50 survivors. And yeah, some of these stories are pretty difficult to hear. But there was one man, a Cameroonian man, 38-year-old called Francois, who his case is particularly interesting because while most people who are dumped don't manage to keep their phones because they get confiscated by the police, by the authorities, before they're loaded onto buses, he managed to hide his and keep it. So he managed to take some photos along the way, and he had a GPS tracker on, which meant that he was able to provide us with that GPS data, and we were able to track his movements, which was really interesting, and then geolocate some of the photos he provided based on those locations. But essentially, he was with his wife and his six-year-old stepson. They were trying to get to Europe. They'd been in Tunisia for, I think, around a year and had found that, you know, he'd been trying to find work, but they were feeling racially discriminated there. So they were on a boat with a couple of dozen other people, and they weren't too far from the shore when the Tunisian Coast Guard vessel intercepted them and stop them, and they were put onto another larger vessel and taken back to shore. Now, at that point, they were beaten with sticks, Francois described, by armed guards, and then they were forced to get onto the buses. There were about 300 of them at that point. They were all loaded onto these buses and then driven like for hours inland. Then when they were around 10 kilometers from the Algerian border, based on his GPS tracking that he provided us with, him and his wife and son were separated from the, I think that the groups were kind of split off at this point. They were put onto another kind of pickup truck with around 28 other people, including two pregnant women. And from there, they were driven again, even closer to the Algerian border, to like an arid canyon area, which we saw on the images that he provided us with. It was around 4 a.m. at this point. And they were then ordered to get off. The Tunisian National Guards that were driving them there ordered them to then cross the Algerian border. So they got off, and with no other option, they went towards that border. But then as they approached, Algerian forces appeared and started firing warning shots at them. So then they felt that they had no other option but to turn back towards Tunisia. They were at this point, still really wet because they'd ended up getting quite wet in the sea, and they were still cold. They had no food. There were a number of children with them. Then as they walked back towards Tunisia, they were detained again by Tunisian authorities and driven back towards the border again. And then Francois' GPS tracking shows that they were at that point, near the border. And he told us that they were kind of at that, they were left there. They didn't have any option of what to do. They were trying to work out how they should, what direction to go in. Do they go towards Algeria, where they don't know anything, and they also had seen these Algerian guards firing shots at them, or do they try and get back towards Tunisia? So then he said they waited a couple of hours, and then they started to walk back towards Tunisia. And then, from the images he sent us, which we managed to geolocate, and from his testimony, we know that it took them 9 days to kind of get back into a nearby Tunisian town. And from there, they were eventually able to get buses kind of back to, I think they'd initially been in Sfax, which is near the coast. But obviously that's a pretty, awful ordeal. And Francois is now, I believe he's still in Sfax, but he's still feeling like he wants to get to Europe because he feels there's no kind of life for him in Tunisia, particularly since that's happened. And also before that, the same sort of thing had happened twice before. So it wasn't the first time. So, he's starting to just feel that his life is completely unsustainable and not possible to continue living in Tunisia. So that was just one story that I thought I'd give you in detail. But there are also others that I can explain a bit more briefly. But one, an American citizen actually called Timothy Hux was in Morocco living as an English teacher. And he was then just detained. Well, he was arrested on the street while he was walking to the shop. And he showed his residency card because he was a legal resident there. But he was still, he wasn't listened to. The police just said, right, get in this van. He was then in the van with a number of black men, and he himself is black. And he was then detained and taken many miles away down to the south of Morocco. Eventually, he managed to get back. But I think this really shows the kind of racially motivated element to all this. Like, they don't even care if you've got a residency card or whatever. It's really focused on trying to round up people who are black and get them away from the coastal areas.
I recently saw a report, which I think preceded in publication your report. This was done by UNHCR and the organization, International Organization for Migration, whose title, like your title, tells you everything you need to know about the content. The title of their report was, "On This Journey, No One Cares If You Live or Die." And it sounds like that is not a bad description of the stories that your reporters generated, like the two you just told, documented, and continue, as you also said.
Yeah, indeed. And I should also say that we know people have died after this has happened. It's actually no secret that a few dozen people are recorded to have been found dead after being dumped on the Tunisia-Libyan border by Tunisian authorities. So people have died after this happened. And I think there are many more deaths we don't know about because they've occurred in very remote areas and haven't been properly recorded. But yeah, you know, as we can see from these stories, no one does care if these people live or die by the looks of it. They're just left in places with no basic essentials. And it includes women and children. You know, it's kind of, yeah, it's discriminant.
Indeed, in the last few days, I've heard a report from the BBC of a new mass grave found in Libya with 60 or 70 bodies in it. It was found back in March, so why it's news in July is a different story, but an interesting one nonetheless. But it's not unknown, and your work, other work, is documenting it. So let's shift then to the government side. First, the Europeans, and then the local governments. As you've said, the Europeans have provided a lot of money to these three countries, but to some other countries as well, Albania, in the UK case, Rwanda, etc. How does that work?
How does it work?
Yeah. Do they just give them money and say, here's how many people you need to stop, which was what the Brits in Rwanda were trying to do. They actually had numbers on everything. In the story you told about the Black American being swept up, are they just counting, you know, we want a full bus because we get paid by the busload? Do you have any sense of what charge have the donors given to the national governments? What do they ask them to do?
From what we've come to understand, it's not particularly, there aren't really particular tasks given, like sort of specific tasks given when this money is handed over. It's pretty vague. I mean, we know that basically it's along the lines of tackling migration, preventing departure, combating the smuggling and the trafficking gangs. There's quite a lot about that. But it's interesting that they don't seem to give, specific tasks like you should be using this tactic in order to prevent this. It's more like make this happen, stop people from coming to Europe, essentially, and do that as you need to do it. And that seems to be what's happening. So Europe is handing over this money and then kind of turning a blind eye as to what is being done with it. It's, you know, it's about they're just after the results. They kind of don't, I guess they don't even really want to know how these North African countries are going to achieve those aims, because they would rather not, because they are entailing severe human rights abuses. And we also know that when this money is handed over, there are not, I mean, the EU actually admitted in writing, I think at some point last year, that they don't have proper, you know, they don't have human rights assessments and proper monitoring on this funding. So there isn't any kind of checks to see that, to ensure that the money isn't being used to commit human rights abuses. And yeah, I think essentially this whole externalization of borders is almost to get it off, you know, in the case of Europe, like get it off Europe's hands, but sure that something is happening to stop it. But by kind of outsourcing it to these third countries, it's almost allowing these human rights abuses to take place that couldn't really happen in Europe because it would be too visible. But it's sort of, it's like out of sight, out of mind. But as long as it's achieving the aims of stopping people, which interestingly, it isn't really actually, like if the question of whether this is even working, I mean, you know, in the case of Tunisia, numbers of crossings have gone down, but actually overall numbers of crossings have gone up. So what happens is people find other ways to get there. They just might not go by that route, but they'll find a different way. It doesn't actually seem to deter people. But anyway, that's kind of another matter. But yeah, it's, you know, as I say, it's pretty vague the way that Europe is asking these countries to use the money. It's just reduce immigration.
Which is odd behavior, since the European Union organizations are known, maybe they're ineffective, but they are known for tracking things. They're known for keeping detailed records. They're known for trying to say, what did I get for my expenditures? You got to prove it. I want reports. What you're suggesting is that in this case, it doesn't seem that kind of behavior. It really is, here's the money, here's the goal, see you next year.
Yeah, and I think that it is much more that, and you're right. I mean, it doesn't, you wouldn't think that really meets the rules and the regulations that Europe would usually stick to.
It does seem weird, because not only is there seems to be no accountability on a from a fiscal point of view, but the European Union is quite proud of its human rights advocacy, talks a lot about it. Every summit talks about human rights. And in this case, there's no fiscal accountability, at least that you guys have been able to discover, and no willingness to talk about human rights consequences of what is clearly going on with the money of the European Union.
Yeah, exactly. And we spoke to a couple of sources from within the EU who actually said, you know, when we're asking about monitoring, you know, because one thing the EU has been saying kind of from the beginning is we are monitoring how our funding is used. We're doing evaluations and we're monitoring it regularly. But actually, sources are telling us, you know, while they might be saying that they're monitoring and they might be doing it to an extent, the reality is that it's, they actually said it's impossible to monitor the uses of the funding and equipment we're supplying. And I guess, you know, it was a choice, I suppose, you know, if they feel like they can't monitor it and how it's being used, should they really be providing it? I guess that's a question. If you're not able to monitor the use, then yeah, then you're kind of accepting, well, we don't really mind not knowing exactly how it's being used. So I think that's quite interesting that even people within the EU who are, you know, working on these things and are very close to the funding and actually are based in North Africa, they're saying, we actually aren't sure what they're doing with it. We can't monitor it.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
I mentioned a moment ago the recent discovery, I have air quotes around discovery, of another mass grave in Libya in the desert, almost certainly migrants, being investigated. The head of the UN Human Rights Organization who made the announcement couched his outrage as aimed at Libya, that Libya must investigate this. Libya must give us answers. Libya must do this and do that. But it's sort of a fiction that there's a government in Libya. It certainly does not control. There's not a single government that controls the whole territory. They are more concerned with their own survival than they are, perhaps understandably, but that's a different issue, with how the migrants are treated, even better if they can get paid. Are they just doing that, do you think? And it's unfair to put the finger on the UN, but it's easy to point to the Libyan government because there's no pushback.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, I think you find with the international organizations, like, for example, the UN, who are, you know, they have a presence in these countries. It was kind of interesting because they, you know, when we were trying to approach them and speak to them, they weren't really willing to say a lot about the EU funding element of it, which was kind of interesting. And even to be honest, they weren't that willing to criticize the national governments, you know, Mauritania, Morocco. But yeah, I guess it's easy to blame that the country where it's happening. And to be honest, it is, you know, those authorities shouldn't be doing this. They shouldn't get off the hook for it because they are the ones carrying it out. But I think it's very much kind of influenced and spurred on, for sure, by this money from the EU. And it is interesting because of the three countries, you know, there is increasing racism and xenophobia within those countries anyway. So a lot of the people living there are angry about the number of migrants and, you know, they want that number to reduce. So it for the national governments, it also works to try to show their populations that they're trying to get rid of people. But then I do think that it's a bit of a vicious circle, maybe, because then we know, yeah, the EU is providing this money and wanting numbers to go down. So when the national governments start to do that and start to say, right, we're getting rid of all these migrants, then it starts to make the local populations think, actually, yeah, there are way too many of these people, and they're, you know, they're also used, governments use them as scapegoats. So, you know, the reason the economy is so bad is because there's too many migrants. I mean, it's the same as what's happened in Europe, in European countries, and I guess the US as well. It's this kind of, this anti-immigrant sentiment is fueled by politicians making it sound like a massive crisis in some ways in order to get votes for themselves, to detract from the real issues like the economy and so on. But yeah, that's a bit of a roundabout answer to your question. But I think, yeah, no, we can't, that those governments can't be off the hook, but we need to remember that a lot of this money is coming from Europe, and a lot of the push to reduce numbers of migrants coming to Europe is coming directly from Europe.
What reactions have you gotten to the work that you've published, to Desert Dump?
Yeah, it had a pretty pretty big response when we published. I think that same day or the morning after, a representative from the EU Commission was asked questions in a press briefing, and the whole press briefing was actually taken up by questions about this, which was interesting. So there was a lot of interest there, and then it's also prompted questions in various national parliaments across the EU. And the EU has said they're going to look into this, which is good. I mean, I don't know exactly what that means, but there have been promises from them that they are going to look at it. But yeah, I mean, nothing's changed yet. I'm even still in touch with a couple of people in Tunisia who are still facing these kinds of things. Like, it hasn't actually stopped as far as I know. I mean, it's certainly happening to some extent still. But I guess it takes time for something like this to actually change. There was a lot of outrage and a lot of shock from, you know, a lot of places. So I think that's a good thing. And you kind of hope that, I guess, European audiences in particular seen it and thought, actually, we don't want this, you know, these operations being carried out with our taxpayer money. I mean, that might put more pressure on the EU to feel this thing is a thing, you know, facilitated by their funding.
Let me ask you one question about the investigative process itself. Managing a team of 40 people who are collaborating, they're not all part of your organization, they're part of lots of organizations. You have a number of media partners. It's a year is a long time. How do you do it? First and second, you had people wandering around some very nasty places, collecting stories, talking to migrants. How do you keep them safe?
Yeah, good questions. Obviously, we're a collaborative newsroom that, you know, this is what we do. We coordinate investigations with a number of journalists from different outlets involved, and it's always a challenge. I should say that there were two other editors from Lighthouse involved in this. So there were, you know, a number of us leading it together because it was such a big one. Just logistically, we would have a weekly meeting about the whole project. And then we also separated out into three countries, Morocco, Mauritania, and Tunisia, and had meetings about each of those each week because different journalists were more focused on those different countries. Otherwise, it just would be, you know, far too much. We had journalists from all sorts of backgrounds, and, we had open source intelligence reporters that was super important for trying to verify what was happening on the ground. For example, with Francois' story, trying to geolocate those images and understand that GPS data. And then we, of course, did have people on the ground, which obviously didn't come without risk. So that was, we had to be incredibly careful. And there were a couple of instances where we had planned for reporters to go to certain places to try to get footage and things or certain things happening. But we had to then cancel kind of last minute because it turned out that it was just the risk was going to be too high for various reasons. But we did manage to do a number of those sorts of trips with, you know, reporters actually gathering footage from the ground, which was really important for the story. I mean, for example, in Mauritania, we got footage of a kind of the whole process of a dump where a pickup truck with about, you know, dozens of black people in it were taken. We saw it going into the detention center, and then they came out in a bus, and then the bus went to the border. And we then spoke to a couple of the women who had been within that group and deported at a later stage. So, yeah, I mean, it wasn't an easy project, and obviously, as you said, it took a year to come to fruition. But I think we wouldn't have been able to do it without that sort of collaboration and, you know, people from journalists with different skill sets and from different places. And I think that was really the only way we were ever going to achieve this kind of, you know, all round in-depth investigation, actually get these findings out. As I said, there'd been reports of this before, but we needed to corroborate. And to do that, it required this sort of collaboration.
All of that leads to my last question, which is a bit unfair. Who cares? You're in the business of speaking truth to power. Is power listening?
Very good question. I mean, I've been working on reporting on migration for the last 8 or so years. And, you know, initially I was focused more on the UK, working for The Independent, and now more wider Europe and beyond that. And it is a question I do often have to ask myself, like, who cares and how can we make people care? Because people do become desensitized to reporting on migration, and especially when a lot of it is about numbers and how many have crossed and how many have got countries, how many have died, even that, or desensitized to that. I think it's important to, when we're reporting on these issues, to make sure we're humanizing the stories as much as possible, because these are people. And I think it's easy for, you know, people in the destination countries to not realize that and to kind of forget that. I think it's also kind of, it's an important point to get across that actually these practices, these increasingly harsh policies that are being brought in, you know, you mentioned Rwanda with the UK, which fortunately is dead in the water now with the new government, but, you know, and this externalization of borders, that it hasn't been proven to work really, which is quite interesting. I mean, so much money has been plowed into these deals and these policies, and actually there hasn't been much evidence that it's having the intended effect. But I mean, that aside, like, whether it's working or not, we need to just remember that we are human beings, and this is human beings that we're talking about. And you would hope that, you know, even those, the top echelons of power, of the corridors of power, will realize that. And yeah, I mean, it's also just about getting it out there to the public that we can't allow, you know, I think it's a lot to do with politicians putting, you know, spinning a certain rhetoric and realizing that that's not always necessarily true. And immigration isn't necessarily a bad thing. Obviously, you want to stop people from risking their lives on the journeys, but it's just not as simple as punish them and hurt them and even, you know, bring in policies that can lead to their death in order to stop them, because that's just completely inhumane and it's not even really working. I don't know if that's a good answer, but, you know, it's a difficult question, but I think it's a very good question.
Let me distill my impression, which is you're going to keep speaking truth to power. You're not sure power's listening, but the only way to find out is to keep speaking.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Just got to keep going. And also, I always think like, even if what you're reporting doesn't lead to change immediately or doesn't lead to change ever, but I think you need to get these things on the record as well, because at least then, you know, at some point in the future, we will have this to look back on. And it's like, those in power did know this. They were warned and maybe they did nothing about it, but it's there. It's on paper, you know.
May Bowman, Lighthouse Reports, thank you for this conversation and good luck.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.